while we're in this limbo where strong forces still want us to go back to maintaining metaphysical hierarchies and objective truths and scientistic kind of thinking, or any sort of, maybe we can use that word authoritarian here, any way of thinking that wants to have, wants one way of looking at things to have authority over the others, to have authority over how we're thinking or talking, then we're in trouble. If we can get to the point where we can give that fully up and focus on conversation and trust, we might be able to take a step forward.
You're listening to Damn the Absolute, a podcast about our relationship to ideas. Produced by Eradicus. Here's your host, Jeffrey Howard.
Welcome, friends, philosophers, and fellow practitioners of ideas. This is Season 2, Episode 3 of Damn the Absolute. First off, I want to introduce you to a new podcast from Eradicus released this past October. Hosted by Derek Parsons, Curiosity Manifold is a podcast that tries to notice easily overlooked aspects of human experience. Through his brief anecdotes and affable storytelling, Derek delivers some philosophy-infused observations that I think will satisfy both the heart and the mind. You can listen to the entire first season now, wherever you listen to podcasts, or at eradicus.co. Secondly, if you're a fan of Damn the Absolute and one of our guests has spurred a thought you'd like to write about, maybe you want to challenge a view they've shared that's just really irked you, Eradicus is always open to thoughtful submissions. Please check out the submission guidelines at eradicus.co for more details. Now, on to our show. Whether it's theology, philosophy, politics, or science, it is not uncommon for people to believe their particular worldview has greater authority over others. This authoritarian approach to ideas implies that one person's representation of truth more closely and certainly reflects reality. They have the truth, and we must submit to it. Alternatively, pragmatists believe this abstract certitude leads to religious fundamentalism, philosophical dogmatism, political absoluteness, and rigid scientism. For thinkers like the late 20th century philosopher Richard Rorty, language is an instrument for coordinating our efforts in addressing concrete issues we face in our lived environments. He doesn't believe theology, politics, philosophy, or science are about acquiring an accurate representation of reality. In fact, he rejects the notion that the nature of truth is one of language mirroring reality. Instead, he views language as a dynamic tool, not something that reproduces truth. Often credited with rehabilitating pragmatism, Rorty encourages us to abandon these authoritarian approaches for what he calls a literary culture. While he holds that none of these disciplines have an epistemically privileged position for which they can determine which truth claims more closely represent reality, they each still play important roles in society. In other words, each provides us with particular vocabularies with different uses. Their vitality resides in the way they empower us to describe and redescribe experiences in continually novel and fruitful ways. Ellen Danielson Huckabee is a research fellow at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology, associated with an EU-funded project on inclusive science and European democracies. She recently graduated with a PhD from the University of Cambridge, where she worked on Rorty's uses of literature in his philosophical work. She believes Rorty's literary attitude gives us more productive ways to move culture, science, and politics forward. A few questions to ponder. What is the role of literature in liberal democracies? What is moral progress for Rorty? How can liberal democracies benefit from embracing a more literary rather than scientistic culture? And how worried should we be about Rorty's rejection of objective truth? I hope you'll contribute to the conversation. Ellen, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to this.
Some people like to emphasize the truths or the values we hold most dearly. We like to sort of do the converse of that and introduce a bit more uncertainty to things. What's a viewpoint you've held in adulthood you were pretty confident wasn't ever going to change, and it's actually shifted dramatically for you?
That's a really good question. And it's been interesting to listen to the previous podcast episodes and hear what people are saying about that. For me, it has a lot to do with today's topic. I guess I was much more kind of scientistic in my 20s, especially. And I did believe in that kind of in science having that kind of privileged position, and in philosophy as having that kind of privileged position as well, where it could sort of give us the more fundamental answers about what was right and what was knowledge and what was true. And our topic of today is Richard Rorty. And I've changed my views on those things pretty fundamentally. So I guess I'm going to go with that kind of answer, that I started looking at both kind of science as philosophy as more akin to literature than I used to before.
Could you pinpoint a specific experience or maybe a thought or maybe a conclusion you came to that caused you to shift away from a more scientistic viewpoint?
I think it was a fairly gradual development. I've always really loved reading literature, and I guess I sort of wanted a way for that to be as important. And as I was reading more and more of Rorty's work, his work did provide that possibility of sort of thinking of literature and philosophy and science as sort of equal in principle, but differentiated in practice and what we did with it and what we needed it for. But I don't think there was a particular kind of moment. It was more a gradual development.
I think that's usually the case for most of us with our views. So we're talking Rorty today, as you mentioned, and we've discussed Rorty a handful of times on the show. There's just so much to mine in the works and the career of Richard Rorty. Who is Richard Rorty? What are a few biographical details we should know about him?
You know, he had an incredibly interesting life story. And I think that when you work on somebody as closely as I have been working on Rorty for the last few years, you end up sort of wishing you'd had the opportunity to meet that person. And that's not something that will ever happen, because he died in 2007 in his sort of late 70s. He was born in 1931 and grew up in New Jersey. He was the only child of James Rorty and Winifred Rauschenbusch, who were sort of intellectuals and political activists firmly on the left in politics, on the kind of outskirts of the New York intellectuals in the 1930s. His father was actually not just a journalist and an activist, but he was also a published poet. And his mother was the daughter of Walter Rauschenbusch, who was a Baptist pastor and a social gospel movement figure of the early 20th century. So Rorty grew up in this home where, like, politics and ideas and beliefs and literature was constantly discussed. He writes a bit about it in two essays that I can highly recommend. They're called Trotsky and the Wild Orchids is one, and then Intellectual Autobiography is the other. And there's a biography by Neil Gross that is definitely worth checking out. So Rorty was really intellectually precocious, and he went to growing up in that kind of environment, I guess, would sort of push you as well in that kind of direction. He went to Hutchins College in Chicago at 15, and he studied philosophy, went to Yale to do his PhD. He actually did a stint in the army, and then he went into a career as in academic philosophy. But he didn't stay in philosophy. He became the Keenan Professor of the Humanities at the University of Virginia in 1982, and then he ended his career as a professor of comparative literature at Stanford. Like, career-wise, he's been credited with being one of the main figures in the revival of American pragmatism as a school of thought in the, at least in the later kind of half of the 20th century. But I think that to sort of properly understand Rorty and his writings and the kind of criticism that is directed at him, we should pay a little bit of attention to the kind of career and life-defining moment that the publication of Philosophy and Mirror of Nature was for him. It's his most widely known book, and it shot him to worldwide fame in 1979, at least kind of intellectual academic fame. And the reason that this moment was so kind of defining was that Rorty was by then an established academic professionalized philosopher working sort of largely in an analytic kind of vein, although not as analytic as some, if you. He was already kind of a person who was accepted as a really good philosopher of influence. And then he published this book that directed a criticism at the discipline sort of from within it. And it wasn't necessarily, the important thing here is not necessarily even the arguments. It was the fact that he was criticizing the self-image of philosophers as philosophers and the discipline as a discipline. A criticism against philosophy as that kind of adjudicator of knowledge and of philosophers as being these people who could sit above all other disciplines and sort of think about how knowledge was properly formed and truths were properly formed. And that provoked a lot of kind of vehemence, really. He became as infamous as he was famous. And he does tell us in some of his writings that it really affected him. And all of this led to a lot of kind of criticism that quite a lot of it, I would say, was misguided and missed the mark, especially in the kind of early years. And there's a chapter in Alan Malakowski's book, Richard Rorty, that really kind of takes that apart and shows how misguided it was. I think that that's kind of the defining moment of his career in life when that gets published. And he sort of becomes this difficult person in philosophy, someone people really needed and wanted to criticize.
Yeah, he's sort of, one way to view Rorty is kind of like the anti-philosophy's philosopher in a way. You talked about him undermining some of these core tenets, and you mentioned Rorty's book, Philosophy in the Mirror of Nature, and a central tenet of that book, or a thesis to it, is this pushback against representationalism, which of course is why Rorty drew so much ire from within the discipline of philosophy. Why was he so skeptical of representationalism?
This was his key kind of problem in Philosophy in the Mirror of Nature, or the key sort of challenge was to challenge this view of language as sort of a universalizing system of representations of the world. I just want to emphasize at first that Rorty is as much of a sort of anti-skeptic as any other pragmatist. That's the kind of a key thing for me to establish at the start here. There's lots of debates about realism, anti-realism and experience, and whether Rorty allows a concept of experience and so on and so forth. And I just want to establish that for Rorty, the world is kind of taken at face value. And that is a classical way of looking at it from Person James onwards. This has always been a part of pragmatism, that the world is sort of taken as at face value. We are bodies that are enmeshed in this kind of experience of being in the world. So that's just not something to sort of question within Rorty's outlook, whether he sort of recognizes that we are that kind of enmeshed and embodied beings. So the problem he has with representationalism is with when representations are put into this kind of system where we are seeking one way of representing the world, where language is seen as something that we might kind of fix and find the right kind of representations that speak the truth about how things really, really are. It's in the title of his book, right? Philosophy and the Mirror of Nature. So the problem is that kind of mirror of nature part, where language is seen as mirroring, as reflecting, or standing in that kind of one-to-one relationship with the world. It's an epistemology, the knowledge about how we create knowledge, to put it quite simply, where the vision or the spectator are like the governing metaphors of how we look at this, right? We look and we map it out, and then we have this transparent language that, if it's done right, lets us see the world sort of through it or by it. And Rorty sort of rejects that quest for that kind of language, right? What he says is that the world doesn't have a preference for words, right? He puts it slightly differently. We might put it that way and say that the world doesn't have any preference for what kind of words we use to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And instead, he kind of wants to go with, he perceives language in line with the philosopher Wittgenstein, important thinker from slightly earlier in the 20th century, who also had ideas that were closely related to those of the early pragmatists. He sees meaning as being established through use, through sort of our use and shared use, conventional use. Language is a sort of, or our words, they're tools. They're at least a kind of sort of mutable and malleable heuristic device that human beings use for our kind of various pursuits and needs and also sort of pleasures. So Rorty wants us to instead see language as, this is slightly later, he emphasizes this more in CIS than in Philosophy and the Mirror of Nature, this idea of noises and marks, which I believe he takes from Davidson, who's a later philosopher of language. He thinks of language as noises and marks that we use or make, we write. Language is metaphors that we sort of gradually come to literalize through establishing a shared use. And eventually they become so familiar as to almost kind of seem transparent. They're just kind of these things we use readily and easily for our purposes. So it's not so much that Rorty denies that there ever can be sort of representations in a kind of local, purposeful sense, right? So he recognizes that if you have a terrain and there's a map of the terrain, then we can establish through convention that this means that this is a high point and this is a valley. There's no denying that. And there's no denying that there's this underlying world that we're sort of trying to coordinate our language and behavior around. But he doesn't like that idea of holding it as a system and seeing language in that kind of metaphysical sense as something that can be grounded if it properly represents the world and experience.
Historically, in philosophy, the representationalist view is largely what people think about when they think about philosophy, that philosophers have this privileged viewpoint from which they can judge other disciplines as to how well other viewpoints or disciplines use language and how well it matches or mirrors reality.
Exactly.
But this anti-representationalism very much connects Rorty to the American pragmatist tradition. You've already alluded to some of these pragmatist thinkers, William James, John Dewey, Charles Sanders Peirce. Richard Rorty's often referred to as a neo-pragmatist. Sometimes, and actually in Philosophy in the Mirror of Nature, he refers to it, his own view, as epistemological behaviorism, but he doesn't want to call it pragmatism because he feels there's a lot of baggage connected to the term. But what is Rorty's relationship, or how does he stand different from the earlier pragmatist thinkers?
So that's a pretty big question, and one that is really, really difficult to answer in a kind of short interview. So I might first sort of just, if not take issue with the word neo-pragmatism, I just want to say that I don't use it and I don't necessarily like it used. the worry I have, right, and this is quite a significant worry to me, is that it gets mixed up with words like neoliberalism, especially since Rorty persistently underscores his commitment to liberalism. And I think that today, a lot of the stuff that he wrote is like, we're talking 40, 20 years ago. And even historically, that term has developed and developed other associations and connotations. And it means different things in different parts of the world. So I think that let's just try and keep Rorty very separate from this idea of neoliberalism, which is hugely problematic. And I think he would stand firmly apart from as well. And also underscore that what Rorty does mean with liberalism is quite a particular kind of thing. He was very firmly on the left in politics. So it's definitely associated with left-leaning social democratic politics. But he also uses Judith Schlar to define liberal in this very specific way as someone who thinks cruelty is the worst thing we do, right? So liberals are those who hold alleviating suffering to be their most kind of pressing obligation. So it's not, I want to just underscore that that's his way of looking at liberalism, and that word neoliberalism just, to me, sort of confuses and draws in the wrong kind of connotations. As far as epistemological behaviorism, that's a kind of a stance that Rorty advanced, but his pragmatism is so much more than that approach. It's not behaviorism as a kind of, in that kind of reductive Skinner-like manner. Michael Williams calls it a kind of taking a third-person perspective, right, in relation to epistemology, in relation to knowledge. It means to look at how human beings, as users of language, come to see the word knowledge come to you, sorry, the word knowledge about certain descriptions. For instance, those that we can sort of justify within a certain language game, or descriptions we have arrived at by following accepted methodologies within an academic discipline and sort of so on. I would definitely say that Rorty recognized his own place as taking up the mantle of pragmatism, classical pragmatism. I don't think that that was problematic for him at all. And I certainly don't see there is a, I certainly see that, you know, there's a continuity there. Rorty, to me, is very much a pragmatist. And I think he saw himself like that as well. And the best way, I think, of understanding Rorty's specific version of pragmatism is sort of to see him as pushing insights from classical pragmatism to their limit, and then sort of examining the consequences of doing so. Sort of saying, okay, we push these things to the limit. What action should we take, and what work should we do if these insights are indeed sort of useful to us? And what he pushes to the limit is this insight that it's not just our ideas that are the products of human imagination and a time and a place and a culture and a language and so on and so forth, but our very words are sort of contingently derived and shaped and used, right? So it takes that, whereas the classical pragmatists had this attitude that ideas were human-made tools that sort of propagated because they were useful, then Rorty takes that down to the level of words, right? And then he says that the key insight here is that faces us with a fundamental choice. It means that all starting points are contingent, right? If everything we say is sort of has a history and is a human-made kind of creation, then all of our starting points are contingent. And it's a fundamental choice in Rortian pragmatism to sort of accept that or not. And contingent here doesn't mean sort of accidental. It just means sort of relational or accumulated or enmeshed, has traces and reverberations, right? And the flip side of everything being kind of in flux or part of a process is that nothing is set in stone in terms of how humans talk or how we use our imagination, how we use words to construe selves and communities and institutions and nations and futures. We can sort of tell a different story. That's what is sort of challenged to us. How do we tell a different story? What do we do now? Where do we go from here? Right? And there's no hiding here. There's no outsourcing of responsibility, because if all of our ideas and our concepts and our ways of sort of construing of what is good and right and wrong is a product of human imagination, then we have to take responsibility as a species for how we're faring on that kind of front, right?
You bring up how much of an advocate of liberalism Richard Rorty is, and that's liberalism broadly understood, especially, I mean, you brought up his definition, which is a liberal is someone who sees suffering as basically the greatest evil, and they're trying to reduce it. A lot of these ideas come out in his later book, Contingency, Irony, and Solidarity. And you've already spoke a little bit about contingency and what he means by that. But what does he mean by irony and solidarity, the two other pillars in that triad?
Yeah, we already spoke a bit about contingency, which we might also sort of say that it stands for the complete rejection of any kind of metaphysical and theological worldview, right? That there's no inevitable trajectories or essences, and that it stands for that kind of basic insight that all starting points are contingent on a range of factors. I just want to sort of emphasize again here that it means sort of dependent upon as much as it does anything else, right? That how we speak and how we view things depends upon like historical events and happenings and influences that have led us to see things this way or talk about it in this way. It's a way to say we are starting in the middle of things, right? And there's this poem that I'm always thinking of when I'm thinking of Rorty's idea of contingency, which is William Carlos Williams, The Red Wheelbarrow, right? It starts literally, so much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chicken. And I just have this image before me whenever I think about Rorty and contingency, of this glazed in rainwater red wheelbarrow upon so much depends, right? So what is depending here? We can do that kind of associative game But it's also worth sort of thinking about how this is just one little piece in all of experience and all of a particular world. And you know, if you want to use that Wittgensteinian term of a life world, this is one little piece. And everything is interconnected and everything is material and everything depends on everything else. So I think that's a good kind of thing to visualize when you're thinking about Rorty's idea of contingency, so that it doesn't veer into that idea of accidentalness or randomness, because it's got much more to do with traces and dependencies. So yeah, contingency, irony and solidarities is Rorty's second biggest book or most influential book. It's not very big, actually. It's only about sort of 250 pages or something. But it's had a really big impact and it's been really widely read also outside of kind of philosophical circles, because it's a profoundly difficult to sort of describe it. In my doctoral thesis, I described it as a call to intellectual action. I think it's a deeply ethical work that tries to work out how we might live and work as sort of intellectuals and as sort of mindful liberals, if we take on board that idea that all starting points are kind of contingent. So the title words, contingency, irony, and solidarity, we covered contingency, but irony means that kind of simultaneous recognition of contingency and the need to sort of act, that we both recognize that our words and ideas are these temporary products of the human imagination, while we also know that we have to adopt and use ideas and concepts. And also, and this is quite important, that we can be ready to sort of stand unflinchingly for these commitments, even to die for them, while knowing we can't ground them on this kind of fundament of ideas or origins, principles that let us say that these are sort of the ultimately right things to believe or the ultimately right things to stand for. Rorty also defines ironism as the kind of awareness of the power of redescription. And by redescription, he means that we describe the world or our experience in it, and then we can also describe it in a different way. And that might sort of change our outlook or change how we think about things or how other people view our situation or what we pay attention to, even what we see as possible. The ironist is keenly aware of the power of redescription. They know that our descriptions are just one way of talking about things, and we might change those things by using our imaginative powers and through action, through imposing that kind of change on our surroundings. And I think that's kind of important to emphasize here, that it also, ironism also has this kind of power of redescription in it. It tends towards emphasizing something I've tried to emphasize in my doctoral work. It's the kind of work dimension in Rorty. He's advocating that we should commit our efforts to, in the service of human flourishing and to lessening cruelty, to lessen humiliation of others. I try to sort of argue that perhaps ironism might need to be replaced or even supplemented or even possibly replaced by a notion of poeticism, because maybe that kind of ironist idiom falls a little bit short. It denotes a kind of attitude towards the world, but it misses out a little on this kind of creative dimension, the making dimension, because can't really be a poet without having a practice. You can be an ironist. You can have an ironist attitude towards our ideas or our language, but ironism doesn't entail having a practice in the same way that poeticism does. Solidarity is at one level that kind of commitment to lessening cruelty, to thinking that all human beings should have the same opportunity to create themselves, to make their own kind of fulfilling lives. It means not prioritizing our happiness in a way that lessens that of others. But it also entails this turning towards each other that follows from a kind of complete rejection of metaphysics. Because when you reject that, the realization is very close to hand, at least, that our only other source of guidance is other people and that kind of conversation that we can have with them. So there's two dimensions there, I would say, to Rorty's idea of solidarity.
Earlier, Ellen, you were mentioning you used an example of a poem and poeticization is very important to Rorty. What exactly does he mean when he talks about poeticization of culture or of fostering a more literary culture?
What I found in the doctoral studies that I've just completed is that this perhaps should have a slightly more important role in thinking about Rortian philosophy than people have previously seen, which as a doctoral student working on this aspect of Rorty, I kind of have to say. otherwise, nobody would pay attention to what I do have to say if I didn't say that it was really, really important. But I actually think that it is important. What I found was that Rorty starts talking about a literary culture from the mid-70s onwards. He takes this term, literary culture, from C.P. Snow, who discussing kind of the lack of communication or understanding between the humanities and the sciences in the early 20th century in Britain especially, used this term literary culture to sort of talk about highbrows who didn't understand science, really. But Rorty sort of reinvents this idea and pits what he calls a literary culture against a scientistic philosophical culture that is intent on this quest to get it right, right? So in opposition, the literary culture accepts that there can be a multitude of descriptions of events and experiences and observations. It has this historicist mindset that is so important to Rorty. It knows that what we say and how we say it is this product of culture and language and time, and that it will be replaced. And the literary culture rests easy with kind of incommensurability, right? With things not hanging together in this big system and coming together in this one vision. In fact, the literary culture celebrates diversity and multiplicity of ways of talking and expressing. So in this culture, universalizing abstractions just seem less useful when that kind of attitude is what dominates, even when they are there, as in sort of classical philosophical works or teleological religious works. These texts will also come to just look like literature, like proposals for sort of how to talk. And in this culture, people will turn more and more to what we traditionally call literature, because it is a genre that already deals with kind of material human concerns, the particulars of human experience. And it's just going to seem more interesting and more useful within a culture where that attitude of resting easy with incommensurability, being historicist, you know, evaluating what's written in relation to its usefulness to human beings, these more material and specific works of writing are going to seem more useful when we are trying to negotiate what it is to live a good human life. And in this culture, the poet, to Rorty, is the vanguard, as he says, of the species. Because the poets, and he means this in a really kind of wide sense, right? Not just literary poets that write like William Carlos Williams. He means poets in this big sense of people who are capable of making it new, that can extend our language and extend our powers of imagination, extend our sort of space of possibilities and understanding of what we should be paying attention to. They are the vanguard of our species. They increase our capacities. So in this culture, it's sometimes thought of as Rorty saying that we need a literary culture where we focus on literary works, and there is often a sort of a vague understanding of Rorty as saying that we have to have this understanding of what we are doing, even when we are creating the texts of physics or philosophy, as writing poetry. But what I try to emphasize in my work is that this is a pervasive attitude in that culture, and one that is really, really important, that sort of shifts focus a little bit in Rorty's idea of this culture to it being more about the attitude he's recommending, this literary attitude, and less about Rorty saying we should turn to literary works for sentimental education and so on and so forth.
Hello, friends. Jeffrey here, doing that podcaster thing and inviting you to rate and review Damn the Absolute wherever you listen to podcasts. It means a lot to me and the editorial team at Eradicus, who produces the podcast. Plus, it helps us continue bringing you meaningful conversations around fruitful ideas. Enjoy the rest of the show. for Rorty in this literary culture, if he is basically placing science and philosophy and literature sort of in the mud together, where none of them have an epistemic privilege perspective, how do we differentiate between philosophy and science and literature if they're all in this literary culture supposed to be more poetic?
Yeah, they're not necessarily supposed to be more poetic. That is a really important question, because it's a really important question, because I do need to say that in no way or form do I want to sort of take away from the importance of science, and especially not in the current climate, you know, with everything that is going on in relation to, you know, the pandemic and with the climate breakdown. It's hugely important to me to not be contributing to denigrating the standing of science. But what's happening in Rortian thinking is that when we debate what's important, we stop looking towards these foundations and saying we need to put all of our effort and thought and respect, we need to place all of that in the realm of science, in the naturalistic sciences, because that's how we're going to arrive at the true representations of things, and that's how we're going to problem solve. This is the way to go about it. Rawlsian thinking moves that discussion to a discussion about purposes and consequences, right? So while you are not making distinctions in on that kind of principled level, you will constantly be making distinctions on the pragmatic level of what is more important and what is more important relative to what your purpose is. So if your purpose is for human beings to have healthy, happy lives, then obviously there are lots of ways of making good, concrete, material arguments for why we need to invest a lot in, for instance, development in medicine, right? Or come to better understand and communicate how we are contributing to climate breakdown and how we might mitigate those kind of effects. The difference doesn't lie in sort of saying, oh, it's all poetry and we don't need to think of it as of one thing is more important than the other. The difference lies in being mindfully aware that what we are talking about it on the level of purposes, about what we want to achieve, and rejecting that idea of trying to sort of anchor what we stand for in principles and origins in that kind of metaphysical way. So it's not taking away from science in any way or form. It really is certainly not my intention to contribute to that kind of sentiment.
So then maybe another way to frame it would be, again, you got to have science, philosophy, literature. None of them has a special insight into reality or some type of unique one-for-one language. Each of them are distinguished by the uses and the practical applications that they have. And they each have a different utility.
Yeah, exactly. And then it's up to us what we want to sort of spend our time doing and how we as a community come together to prioritize and say, this is how we would want to talk about certain things. This is what we should work towards. This is how we should spend our money, that kind of stuff. But it does away with the need for sort of establishing those kind of foundations and stuff. And that's the big and defining difference here. It's not about sort of saying it doesn't matter and everything is now poetry and we can't stand for something, we can't fight for something, we can't believe in something. Quite on the contrary, actually, I would say. And another thing, that poetic attitude, what that also means is that if we can cultivate the thought that even those texts of science and philosophy and sociology, whatever you want to talk about, are literature in that, or poetry in that sense of being human-made creations, what it enables us better to do is to hold them more lightly, right? And that means to take them less seriously, not in the sense that we are not to take the consequences of how we talk seriously, because Rorty takes those consequences seriously indeed. Mm-hmm. But it enables us to cultivate an attitude where we are more willing to give them up, right? So we might not be so committed to holding on to things that might be expressed in better ways or might be thought of in better ways. It cultivates openness, and it cultivates that key tenet of classical pragmatism, fallibilism. It's basically a form of fallibilism, right? You remain willing and open to find better ways to talk and act. And thinking of all of these things as on par on that kind of principled level just makes it easier, at least for me, to think of even the texts of science as something that we might, 50, 100 years from now, we might talk about certain aspects, at least, of science in a completely different way. And that's unproblematic within this outlook.
In this literary culture, we have science in its field with its uses, philosophy with its uses, and then literature. And this is at the heart of a lot of the work you're doing is looking at Rorty's uses of literature. What are some of the uses that he finds in literature? Some of the most concrete practical consequences of literature?
What I've been trying to disentangle a little bit in Rorty is this, what is literature for within his work, right? So I started off with this idea that literature in a very concrete sense is important to Rorty. So plays and novels and poems and whatever, right? And then I started realizing that in Rorty's narrative, it means that much wider attitudinal thing. But I did keep returning to that question of why then are specific works of literature in this traditional sense still so important? What is it that they can do, as you say, which is the key pragmatist question? What I've tried to argue is that while Rorty's is a sort of thoroughly de-essentialized and institutional, functional concept of literature, his centering of literature in that narrow sense entails an acknowledgement of literature as a sort of a conventional label for a tradition that has curated a lot of texts that managed to arrange words in such a way that they are effective at unsettling us. They're effective at unsettling settled selves. Rorty uses a phrase he takes from Vladimir Nabokov to describe these patterns. He talks of words arranged in iridescent patterns, right? This is how they come in as having an important moral function, a function for moral progress, because when we're unsettled is when we are more likely to resettle, to regroup in a new way. These texts, they blow open that room for growth and change. So literature in Rorty is not just important for that kind of sentimental identification that is often associated with Rorty's view of literature. He also talks about shudders of awe, of disgust as well. It's as if literature gives us the kind of prodding which upends us in some ways and shakes us about and makes us grasp for alternatives. And Rorty's focus on language matters here because he sees ourselves as consisting of a vocabulary, really, or not ourselves as sort of bodies, but the way we talk about ourselves, our self-conception in that way, it consists of words, some more central to us than others. These very central words he calls our final vocabulary. If those words are taken from us, we would have to radically alter our self-image to sort of replace that way we used to see ourselves as defined by that specific word. So literature, even though Rorty also talks about TV series and ethnography and the journalist report and various other kinds of genres that describe human experience in a very detailed and specific way, I think that it matters here that literature provides us with alternative words, new words that we can, when we are in that kind of unsettled state, we can find words that help us tell a new story about who we are. And we do need a firm sense and positive sense of who we are to be agents in our own lives and sort of agents of change. So it's really important to Rorty that we have this sense of self. So literature plays a much more complex role in his narrative and philosophy than is often thought.
There's sometimes this presentation of Rorty's thought on literature, that literature as this transformational process, that if we get enough people to read good literature, then we can develop this liberal democratic utopia. How fair of a reading of Rorty is this perspective?
I don't actually think that's a fair reading at all. at least I do think that it's a lot more complex than that, right? There's a more dynamic interplay taking place between the emergence of literary criticism and literature in our contemporary sense of that being a function of the Enlightenment or that kind of social changes that were taking place back a few hundred years ago by now. And that kind of literature and literary criticism as a genre pushing and developing our capacity for democracy, for liberalism. And this, it's Rorty's idea of literature just isn't this kind of simplistic, we will read novels and then we will have moral progress, we will understand other people better, and then that will make us more compassionate and we will do better by other people. He sees literature as a political force through history that has contributed to the freedoms we have today. And what he wants is to keep this going, right? He's asking us to keep these practices and institutions going, to recognize their importance, because looking back, we can see that there has been a sort of a co-emergence of literary criticism as a genre and liberal democracies, and what he thinks these things are related. And if these things are related, then we need to keep it going if we want to keep developing liberal democracies, right? So he does talk about sentimental kind of identification, but he's often more interested in the ways that more complex works of literature can, as I said, unsettle us. He pays particular attention to narrative and modernist literature. He actually talks about some books as being sort of inspirational and stimulating versus books that are relaxing. And those relaxing books, and this is the difference, those relaxing books leaves the reader's self-conception intact, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not so much about that sentimental identification as it is about what I said previously, that some books manage to unsettle us, to create that room and possibility for change and expansion. And Rorty is not making big claims here. He's saying things like it might increase the likelihood that we're willing to change, or might increase the likelihood that we as a society tend towards other practices. So it's that kind of naive, we will read novels and become more empathic people. He does recognize that that can sometimes happen. Like, he underscores novels like Uncle Tom's Cabin and Black Beauty as novels that have had that kind of societal impact. But he's more concerned with, you know, 1984 and Lolita, which are complex works of literature. They don't fit that sentimental identification picture, and yet they are the centerpiece of the last part of CIS, right? So I genuinely do believe that it's this more complex way of thinking about literature's effects on us as unsettling, and that ability to unsettle as being tied to the kind of expansion of mindset and understanding that we need to keep making a better society and a better democracy.
Rorty's an incredibly political thinker. The sort of his overall project, whether it's pushing back against representationalism or emphasizing the contingency of language, reducing suffering, some of the changes that can happen within a literary culture. Behind it all is really this political project. But there are those who are skeptical or critical of Rorty because they worry that his anti-representationalism invites this sort of reckless relativism. How fair of a criticism is it to say Rorty's a relativist? And if so, should we be worried?
Now, that's a good question. He did worry about it himself, right? So he tried to write about it a few times. And the short answer for me is that no, he's not a relativist in the sense that a lot of people will perceive that word. And no, we shouldn't be worried. So I can try and explain a little bit. The idea of relativism is sort of worrisome. Only makes sense if one, it can only be formulated if one thinks that there is an underlying sort of truth or state of things to be discovered or adhered to and put into words. If there is this hierarchy of truths or knowledge or ways of representing or disciplines, then relativism might seem very much like a problem, right? Because if you believe there is an order to things and somebody comes along and says, actually, there isn't, then they look like they're trying to upend that hierarchy. And that would be a problem if that's the way you thought this is how we should go. That's kind of, this is how we should structure and organize our thinking. And this is how we should structure our search for moral progress. But if you don't think that that makes sense in the first place, you can't make sense of the idea of like this notion of relativism either, right? There is just this level playing field, and then we just make our distinctions in practice, as we've been talking about. You make your case through justification relative to, you justify what you want to do and why you want to do it through talking about purposes and why we all should care about something or pay attention to something. And you're not so concerned about that kind of fundamentalist level of trying to make sense of why something is more important than something else on a metaphysical level. So the problem in one way sort of can't be formulated. On the other hand, what you're left with is that problem that Rorty worries about, which is, given that everything is contingent, or all starting points are contingent, I should say, all sort of formulations and the way we conceive ourselves and our institutions and what a nation is and what a human being is, given that all of that is just contingent starting points for how we might talk or where we might go from here, the question then is, where do we go from here, right? How do we now proceed? And Rorty did, that was kind of what CIS was an attempt at answering. It was to figure out how we could, aware of that contingency, find a way to think and talk and stand for our moral values, our beliefs, while always sort of having in the back of our minds that they are contingent in that kind of dependent sense, right? They are not groundable in the metaphysical sense. But I don't think that moving the conversation to the level of purposes and consequences and practices and actions is worrisome at all. There's a book I'm reading at the moment by my friend Tracy Lanera, who's written a book about how Rortian pragmatism gives us strategies for not overcoming the question of relativism and nihilism, but outgrowing it, coming to see it as not making sense and not being a question we should worry about anymore. The question she wants to center, and that she takes Rorty to also want to center, certainly in his later work, is the problem of egotism, of which is the opposite of sort of standing in solidarity with other people. And moving our efforts and our thinking to these kind of pragmatic problems, I don't think that's a problem. There's nothing relativistic about making active pragmatist commitments instead of settling for making metaphysical ones.
If there's this, whether someone wants to call it relativistic angle to Rorty or a contingent approach, whatever language someone wants to use to describe that, How does Rorty evaluate, as we look forward, how does he evaluate whether we're making moral progress or not? How does a Rortian have any sort of assurance that, well, what we're doing now is better than what was happening 5-10 years ago, whether that's along gender equality, in any sort of social issue you want? How do we know we're making progress?
Well, you don't. You don't in that kind of systematic, abstract sense. We can't arrange historical events on a trajectory from once upon a time we were morally underdeveloped and now we are tending to become really sensitive and we have got it figured out and we are now doing right by all people. That's not how this is viewed at all within the Rortian or the pragmatist outlook. Rorty encourages us, both in terms of when we evaluate our own behavior and outlook, and when we think about how nations are faring relative to other nations, or how we are faring at a moment in time relative to another moment in time, to evaluate it comparatively, first of all, and if we're going to evaluate it comparatively, we are again back to talking about purposes, right? So we can say that our overarching goal is, with royalty, to lessen cruelty, to sort of be able to put into words more and more, become better able to put into words how we humiliate other people or how we might detract from their capacity for having flourishing good lives. If that's our overarching purpose, then we can compare things relative to each other with that purpose in mind, right? So I might say that, as you said, not letting women vote or drive cars is to take away from their capacity for human flourishing. And because that is what I want to discuss, I want to discuss how we can contribute to human flourishing, then I would say that countries that allow women to drive, they are morally more progressed, so to speak, than countries that don't allow that. I don't like necessarily that language of moral progress. And Rorty was ambivalent to talk about morality as something in and of itself as well. So it's a little bit kind of difficult. But we can regress as well. We can sort of see now that we are doing worse, maybe on some measures, than we used to. From this point of view, there are no algorithmic solutions, not for ethical problems, not for moral problems, not for political problems. It's about constantly sort of grounding our thinking in what's happening here and now and thinking about those purposes, grounding what we're doing in what we want to achieve and figuring out ways to solve things, not necessarily on a case-by-case, in a case-by-case manner, if that means looking away from what we've already learned or what we think we know about something, not at all, but in a case-by-case manner, in the sense that we take into account the specificity of the situation we're in now and the specificity of what it is we want to do.
I want to wrap up with maybe one final question for you, Ellen. There are a lot of commentators that are lamenting that we're in a post-truth age. And part of that is just this massive amount of information or misinformation that abounds. And some of it feels like this reckless relativism, which we sort of talked a little bit about. And on the other hand, you have someone like Rorty, who in some ways doesn't really have that much interest in truth, at least in the traditional framing of truth, that he's more interested in are the purposes we're aiming for and what we discuss and decide amongst interlocutors. So how do we sort of fit that together of the concerns of being in a post-truth era while still seeing benefits in a different type of post-truth approach?
So I believe that we would be better off if we, as a society, fully recognized the kind of Rortian insight that, as you said, truth isn't necessarily that important. I mean, it's important as a way of expressing what we think of something and important as a way to coordinate ourselves as language users and coordinate behavior. But in that kind of fundamental finding the truth or finding absolute objective knowledge and that kind of thinking, I do think that we're better off along Rortian lines as a society. I just think that, no, I don't think there's any way back to a world where people in general think that there is one truth, right? I think we're past that point. Maybe that whole, you know, subjectivist opinionating has gone way too far, right? But that probably has its roots in the last kind of 50 years at least, more, where culture as a whole has become more aware that there are many aspects to truth. There are many descriptions of the world that we can have, and that we can have opinions and have conversations and from that point on negotiate what's right and what's wrong and true and not true. And I don't think there's any way to sort of put that cat back in the bag. It's out. We can't go back. We can't reinstate objective truth in that metaphysical sense and make people adhere to that kind of worldview. So if you're there already, that people think that what we need is conversation or not necessarily conversation, but if people are already wanting to voice their opinions and perhaps being less willing to cooperate and less willing to listen to other people, I don't think that we necessarily need to prioritize how to establish truths. I think we need to prioritize how to establish trust. I think we just worry. I worry that we're spending our energies on the wrong thing. I think that we need to find out how we can have better conversations, how more people can be heard, and how we can get better at acknowledging each other and the kind of perspectives that people want to get across. We're in this kind of worldwide shouting match at the moment, and it doesn't work. It's not going to work to thump somebody over the head with what you say is the truth and expect people to assent to that. But you might have a chance if you can work out how to have better conversations and just plainly say, right, I don't have the ultimate objective truth, but maybe we can work together to work out a way to talk that will work for us. So, yeah, I think that Rorty's strategies might offer a way to think about what's going on today, where pushing what Rorty says to its limits and applying that to our situation today might yield interesting perspectives on how to move forward. Because I just, while we're in this limbo where strong forces still want us to go back to maintaining metaphysical hierarchies and objective truths and scientistic kind of thinking, or any sort of, maybe we can use that word authoritarian here, any way of thinking that wants one way of looking at things to have authority over the others, to have authority over how we're thinking or talking, then we're in trouble. If we can get to the point where we can give that fully up and focus on conversation and trust, we might be able to take a step forward.
Ellen, thank you so much for coming on the show. Thank you so much for letting us dive deeper into Rorty, and hopefully we can build a little bit more trust amongst each other as we try and coordinate against some of the big pressing challenges we have, whether it's climate change, pandemic we're still in right now, you name it. So again, thank you so much.
No, thank you for having me. It was great being here.
Thanks for listening to Damn the Absolute. I want to show some love to those of you who've recently been talking about Damn the Absolute or Eradicus online, specifically you folks on Twitter. So I want to give a shout out to Mark Sanders, Ironist Nick, Slufflux, and Charlie Diaz. Tweet at us at Eradicus Mag or me at Jeffrey_Howard_. You can pester us with some of your favorite quotes from Damn the Absolute guests or recommend episode ideas. And again, please rate and review us wherever you listen to podcasts. It really goes a long way in helping us to foster a community committed to fruitful ideas. See you all next time.